Rob Wolf, Andy D is back with episode 42, The Paleolithic Solution. What in the world is up?
Well, episode 42, from A Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, this is the answer to all the questions in the universe. So maybe we should stop with this episode. I don't know. Maybe we should just wrap everything up with this.
I thought it was broad time modal domains.
Well, yeah, that's probably in the follow-up book, I'm sure, which I never got to. No, I did get to that one, like Life, the Universe, and everything. So
not near as good as the first one.
They're all good, though. Douglas Adams was a rare gem of a genius. What's new with you?
I just did a little training. You know, my hip is a little achy, but that's all right. And I'm enjoying some afternoon water, which is not very exciting at all. Mm. And I'm sweating because I'm still hot from training. And I have to trim my beard, Rob. That's the big thing for the day, probably, this afternoon.
Just don't trim the beard near the water. That could just get really, really nasty. So,
well, your wife, Since we're working at, you know, we have a booth at the bridal fair in Chico this weekend, your wife, requested that I manicure my beard a little bit.
I don't know, man. You know, Chico chicks are a little either on the you know, wild, woodsy side, so that beard could just whip them into a mating frenzy. That could be bad for their marriages to be, I guess. So
exactly. And how many weeks out are we from Rob Wolf Book Tour version 1?
Well, you know, September 4, we're going to be in Brooklyn, New York. Actually, August 28th, we're going to be in Monrovia for Paleolithic Solution Seminar. These are all Paleolithic Solution Seminars. August 28th in Monrovia, California, Brooklyn, New York, September 4th. September 11th, we're in Atlanta, Georgia, and October 9th, we're in Hellerup, Denmark. And then spackled in between all of that, we're going to have 17 to 30 stops related to the book itself, basically book signings. We're going to do the whole Eastern Seaboard and then head back into California, hit California, and potentially like Seattle, Portland. We're still kind of playing around with that. That's going to be phase one of the book tour, and then we're probably going to kind of go to ground for a while because we'll be getting up close to the holidays. And then I believe in January, February, we're going to be back out, hit the middle of the country and Canada, and then we're being unleashed on the UK and Europe and Australia and New Zealand, and those dates are to follow, but they're going to be a little bit further down the road, primarily due to the fact that it takes some time shipping the books overseas, and so we kind of stagger that at least a couple of months to make sure that they have books there.
That's interesting. We're actually going to go back to recording the podcast right before we post them, Rob, right? We're going to attempt to record Rob Wolf on the Road.
Yeah, you know, we've tried to archive these things, and that's been good. It takes a little bit of the pressure off, but then if we have an announcement or if we wanted to keep people updated about where we're going to be on the road, then obviously it's not very timely. So this may be like the worst idea that we've ever had, but we're gonna try to basically make this happen. Like, while I'm on the book tour, we're going to do podcasts from the road, and we'll just see how it happens. We have a MiFi hookup, and we've used that a couple of times in some remote locations, and it's worked so far, so we'll give it a shot and see. So, I mean, what's the worst that could happen?
I'm sorry,
so.
We don't want to have an episode, and people will harass me on Facebook.
It was just late one time, and I thought that there was going to be an uprising. I was like, Andy, put it up, please.
And, you know, my goal for the book tour, Rob, I've given some thought to this, is we need to get you on the Colbert Report. That's what I think is the ultimate achievement right now.
Colbert Report, Daily Show, or Chelsea Lately. I think Chelsea Lately is pretty hot. I'm not really into blondes, but she's pretty sassy. And if I could hit any of those shows, my life would be complete. I could just like curl up and die after that. So
we've thrown it out there to our 6 listeners. So if anyone can help, let us know.
Yeah, if anybody knows somebody who knows somebody, then we'd love to do that. So,
well, I didn't tell you this, Rob, but you know, you have friends in powerful places. I have a client who went to film school, and he lives in Chico, and his buddy's been pretty successful in Hollywood. I think he's a film editor, and he works with all these celebrities. And, you know, my client relayed the story to me that, you know, my buddy works with all these famous people, but he was really excited that I work out at Rob Wolf's gym. And I'm like, I don't know what that says about your buddy or Rob Wolf or the world. Something's wrong with this situation. But
yeah, there's a disconnect there. There's a serious disconnect there. We should probably get him more of a social life so that he's got some balance there. But that's cool.
Well, he'll probably listen to this episode and, you know, we'll get harassed. So or he'll stop listening based on this story.
Well, we seem to have a rotating, you know, six listeners no matter what we do, so that'll be fine.
All right, are you ready for the questions?
I'm ready to roll, man, especially since we're opening up with Tane.
Yes, Tane always is good for a few laughs.
We need to get that guy on the show at some point, so
yeah, seriously, yeah. All right, here we go. Rob and Andy, another infotaining podcast from Chico, aka the Paleo Mecca. Clearly Tane has never been to Chico.
It is a big enough backwater to be a paleo mecca. It is almost like going back in time 100,000 years. So I can see it. It works.
Brace yourself for a long post. This is one of my few weekly opportunities to write for fun and in English. In terms of the mention of the difference between elite performance versus health and longevity, I read a great quote in a book last week, By the Sword, thoroughly recommended, but I'm kicking myself that I left it in Rehad, so I can't quote verbatim. It was a comment by a senior East German Olympic athletics official along the lines of, elite sports begin where healthy sport ends. Thrashing yourself into a paste every day is probably not best in the long run. In the service we used to stay, there are old soldiers and bold soldiers, but no old and bold soldiers. It's a common observation in combat units that take themselves seriously that once guys have finished their 20 years, they aren't leaving in better shape than when they joined, despite doing lots of hard exercise over a long period. Perhaps a more accessible example is in professional sports, CrossFit football John Wellborn. Judging by his blog post, he has sustained and played through some gnarly injuries. Aside from talent and determination, the prime difference between him and the everyday athlete crushing themselves 3-on-1 off is that he was well compensated for his pains and money, fame, and cheerleaders, allegedly.
No comment on that.
Cost benefit, risk reward. As far as the pregnancy topic is concerned, it sounds like you and Andy offer a full service to clients. I have a mental image of you guys resembling the lab that produces Arnold Schwarzenegger in the film Twins. Perhaps you should rebrand to NorCal Stud and Conditioning to really get the clients rolling in. Oh, death to gluten, Tane.
There was a question where
there was no real question, more of a comment. Well, anyway, I thought we could touch again on the difference between, you know, elite performance, health, and longevity. I need to read this book. I've not read this. I'm not familiar with actually By the Sword, which, you know, I feel like I'm familiar with a lot of books, so I'm out of the loop on this one.
I'm not familiar with that one. I'm not sure what he's talking about with us causing pregnancies in the gym. I'm just not sure where this thing is coming from at all.
Basically, I think Tane was offering his two cents on you know, elite performance versus health and longevity, which I think we've talked about at length. But it is an infotaining post. And totally. From the Paleo Mecca. And I think he makes some really good points about, you know, obviously well-worn pro football, lots of injuries, long-term damage, but, you know, was obviously compensated a little differently than your average CrossFitter or hard training person.
Yeah, and I mean, this is one of those interesting things when we have this kind of theoretical model of sickness, wellness, fitness, and then kind of supra fitness or whatever, and it's really intellectually appealing, and it appealed to me early on because it has that kind of like fractal nature, you know, self-similarity at all levels, like the same deal. What's the line? The needs of our grandparents, Olympic athletes, to differ by degree, not kind.
Yep.
And it was very, very appealing to me, and it still spins some wheels in me that I really like, because again, that like kind of fractal element. If people want to geek out on this stuff, checking out like Stephen Wolfram, like cellular automata, fractals, like some really fascinating stuff. It's self-similarity at all levels. Like, you don't really change the basic pattern or the basic signal, whether you're talking cracks in a tiny piece of concrete or whether you're talking cracks on the San Andreas Fault running down the middle of California. And this is where a lot of this fractal stuff comes up. And there was some talk early on about like fractal programming, and Pavel has kind of alluded to this stuff. It's some really kind of out there, wacky stuff that I don't know if it has huge application, but it's very appealing. And part of this thing was that, you know, the needs of just about everybody is all the same. You know, like the Olympic athletes, the biggest problem that they face is a lack of GPP and stuff like that. And I think as we've massaged this thing and kind of played with it, it's an interesting idea, but it just hasn't borne itself out. And it's specifically this point of a health, you know, performance, health, longevity, this intersection, which I think I wrote about in like 2005 in the performance menu, kind of alluding to this idea of like a triple point analysis. Instead of it simply being a spectrum, that there's actually a triple point. It's similar to like the phase diagram of water, like solid, liquid, gas. A triple point is the point at which the temperature and pressure, all of these things all happen at the same point. And I had this kind of idea in my head that we could maybe map performance, health, and longevity, performance being whatever it is that you want to do, health being your moment-to-moment health, and you know, we could have a zillion different markers of that, but, you know, just do you have cancer, do you not have cancer, do you have a cold, do you not have a cold, do you feel good, do you not feel good, you know, we could figure out some different markers for that. And then longevity, which longevity would then be health extrapolated over time, and that there's probably some divergent points with this. There might be some cost-benefit analysis that goes on with kind of optimizing one versus the other, and we certainly see this with caloric restriction and the attempt at really improving longevity, in which these people actually become more susceptible to certain types of diseases, certain types of injury, and their performance is shite. I mean, they lose most of their muscle mass. They're in a constant caloric deficit, which obviously their body kind of reaches an equilibrium point with this, but they're not experiencing good performance, but they could potentially, you know, like double their average lifespan. And that's some kind of like out there on the edges perspective on this stuff. And then you bring it back in and look at just epidemiology on sportive endeavors. And it's obvious that the performance demands of professional athletes are completely antagonistic to longevity, both health and longevity. And Barry Sears alluded to this in his first book, talking about the work volume, the work capacity necessary to be a competitive elite level athlete is such that you're exposing yourself to enough oxidative damage and wear and tear that it ends up shortening life. And so that's a really interesting observation. And I remember talking with Dave Warner, where he talked about guys that were in the SEALs that would, you know, stay up all night drinking, just whooping it up, get up the next day, they would PT and they kicked everybody's ass at PT. But then over a 5-year, 10-year period, these guys ended up burning out real fast. And I think we ended up talking a little bit about like the, who's the Olympic swimmer guy we just talked about?
Mark Spitz.
The Spitz versus like Dara Torres, you know, all that sort of stuff. It Phelps kind of gig, and I think that's a real nice intersection with this stuff, where, you know, the dude, you know, Phelps is eating 12,000 calories a day to do the performance that he's doing, but he's probably going to age real similar to Phelps, which isn't all that great. But then you've got Dara Torres, who just generally has eaten better, and I think probably has generally taken better care of herself. Maybe she's just got some outstanding genetics, but I think some maintenance along that way has really helped her a bunch. But it's a really interesting kind of thought experiment, and I think that a lot of people, when they're tinkering with their fitness, it would behoove them to maybe put a little bit of thought towards this stuff. And I think when you look at some folks like Michael Rutherford, Max Effort Black Box, and he has some nice periodization that he plugs into his yearly cycle. Like, he has a period of time where he really focuses a lot more on kind of like interval running, maybe even some middle distance running, you know, 1 to 3 miles in addition to some shorter intervals. Then he'll go through an Olympic weightlifting kind of gig, and he'll even do a little bit of bodybuilding here and there. God forbid, some curls and, you know, glute ham raises and tricep extensions and stuff like that. But he has a nice periodized schedule throughout the year where he switches it up, keeps it fun. And I can't really think of very many people that are around 50 years old that have the capacity that guy does, and really good mobility, really good health, and he still really enjoys training. So it's an interesting interesting thought experiment. Definitely, I think, something that would be worthwhile for trainers, coaches, everybody to give us some thought about, like, why are you doing what you're doing? You know, if you want to be a great athlete and you aspire to doing that, then just understand that there may be some cost-benefit analysis there. And if you're generally shooting for, like, a health and longevity bias, then you might give some thought to how you plan your training on a yearly basis, and your food and your sleep and all the rest of that stuff. Good stuff, as usual, from Tain.
Rob Wolf,
dude.
And for me, this one, you know, is always easy to answer because, you know, being 32, you know, four surgeries on my left knee, no cartilage left, degenerative right hip that everyone says needs to be replaced, and it's like thinking about, okay, do I want to try to beat my best friend time, or should I try to keep my hip, you know, as long as possible instead of getting it replaced when I'm 45? And so for me, that, you know, it's really easy because I was like, okay, a bunch of stuff is not good for my knee. You know, really makes my hip flare up. Probably not going to spend a lot of time doing thrusters and or chasing my best Fran time versus finding stuff to do that's fun and challenging, but that makes my hip better. Sure, I'm probably not going to compete in the CrossFit Games, but I'm not sure that I care, you know, if I can somehow keep my current hip as opposed to getting a new one in 20 years.
Yeah, that's big stuff. I mean, that's huge stuff, and is good. You know, nobody likes the specter of surgery. Nobody likes. I mean, there's just no good outcome to that other than just trying to tinker your circumstance to the best of your ability so that you know minimize the damage, maximize the benefits. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people would benefit from doing a little bit of that cost benefit analysis. And it's kind of funny when you start getting in and tinkering with this stuff and looking at people who age pretty well, they've got a little bit of a bodybuilding orientation on their stuff. You know, they, I think certainly mobility, functionality, all that stuff is really, really important, really, really critical. But some of the old, you know, kind of Clarence Bass, Dave Draper-esque type stuff, those dudes age pretty well. And they, you know, they kept an eye on functionality for sure, but intervals for their cardio, you know, switching off between full body bodybuilding type stuff versus parts and pieces, you know, split routines and everything. And there's some pretty cool benefit to stuff like that. I would still steer it more towards like a gymnastics rings and prowler pushes and different stuff like that, but I think there's some really interesting stuff to be had out of that whole quarter for a really kind of focused anti-aging approach.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this a little bit at the gym about, you know, I feel like everyone needs to deadlift and or hip hinge, but I think depending on the person, you know, I think you take a look at, you know, traditional sumo, Romanian, and probably cycle through that. And some folks, just given the way they're built, maybe they shouldn't spend 95% of their time doing a traditional deadlift. Sure, they should be able to get in that position and do it, but maybe that's not the best position for them to spend, you know, the majority of their training time.
Right, right. And particularly just for some sort of arbitrary performance standard, like doing a Diane workout, like a 21:59 deadlift, handstand push-up kind of gig. You know, if we're just seriously battling orthopedic issues, let's switch that up and make it more about actually mobilizing, strengthening, you know, integrating muscular firing and all that sort of stuff. It's really interesting. I don't know if it was you or somebody else, but they pointed out that, you know, for so long it's been this focus of movements, not muscles, to the point where now we have people who really don't know how to activate glutes and hamstrings. When they push the prowler, they feel it in their quads, and you're like, how in the name of God are you doing that? You know, yep. But it's some really wacky stuff is happening where folks become so quad dominant and they get drilled into these wacky movement patterns that it seems virtually impossible to get them out of. And
yeah, I think
it seems new.
Yeah, I think the first person that I read about that thought, Brett Contreras, I think Wellborn posted on CrossFit Football. He's known as the glute guy, and he likes the hip thrust and all this stuff. And he made this comment that, you know, the pendulum has swung so far that just what you're saying, like, people are so detached from what muscles are supposed to fire. They think, okay, I'm going to get in position, I'm going to pull this weight off the floor, and then magically, you know, the right fibers will fire at the right time. And clearly we're seeing that's not always the case, and folks need to be a little bit aware of what they're trying to accomplish.
Right.
The same thing I think Starrett's pointed at plenty of times out on, you know, the kipping pull-up. You know, there's a difference between the hollow and getting in position and integrating your core versus allowing your legs to, and your pelvis just to whip around wildly just so you can get to the top of the bar.
Yeah, and the two movement patterns have really different outcomes after 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 repetitions.
Definitely.
So, yeah.
Good job, Tane. As always, we love your posts.
Yeah, if you ever make it to Chico, we will definitely take you on a bar crawl. So
it'll be like 5 stops. I'm just kidding.
We'll start early before Andy and Rob pass out at 8 p.m. So yeah,
exactly. All right, good. Moving on. I've got a pretty lengthy question from James. Hey, Rob, thanks for the podcast. Really learning a lot since recently becoming a convert. In the last 2 months or so, I've got some questions about applying the paleo diet to my possibly abnormal case. I'm not looking to lose weight and not coming from a CrossFit background. I recently graduated from university where I was a lightweight rower, so basically a power endurance athlete. My goal now is to try to make my national team in the coming years, so I'm continuing my training, and I'm sold that improving my diet, eating paleo, could play an important part. I'm a light guy, definitely not the naturally jacked type, unfortunately, though a good thing for my sports. I'm always trying to put on muscle as well. 6'2", 72 kilograms, probably 8% body fat, and about 9 to 10 workouts a week, including lift 3 times and a lot of long, slow distance. Here's my problem. I really literally don't know what to eat to get enough calories to build muscle and recover fully. I can make a lot of great paleo-type dinners, steak and veggie or something, and I love it, but I really need to eat all day. I basically graze throughout the rest of the day on eggs and any leftover meat, but mainly it's tuna, salmon, salads, veggies, berries, that kind of thing, which just don't provide enough calories. I haven't gone super strict paleo, and that way I keep the way, still eat some cheese and maybe some peanut butter, occasional peanut butter binge, have cut out grains for the vast majority. Basically, I'm just trying to figure out how I can eat paleo throughout the day to keep my protein and calories up. I can absolutely destroy a tub of nuts or almond cashew butter, which I end up doing fairly regularly, but I really do think that hurts more than it helps. I often feel pretty terrible on workouts when I overeat on nuts, possibly from the anti-nutrients, and I know it absolutely destroys the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio. The sheer amount of omega-6 and a cup or so of almonds, walnuts, cashews, pecans, etc. is obscene. Unfortunately, I think I run on too little calories a lot of the time and then end up overeating on nuts for a calorie-dense and delicious food source. I like eating, so that's not the issue. Not one of the hard gainers who complains about having to eat too much. I just can't cook enough to eat steak 3 times a day, or I'd have no life aside from cooking and eating. I love sweet potatoes, but I'm not sure I would still if I was eating them 5 times a day. I could eat nuts all the time, or I could start eating bananas all the time, but I think neither of those are going to be very good, right? I feel like the answer is that I absolutely must start chugging coconut milk or doing shots of olive oil, but I'm not a big fan of consuming calories just to get calories and not into weighing food and counting calories. Any recommendations? Thanks a million. Keep up the good work. Looking forward to getting multiple copies of the book for my family.
Wow,
that was a long question.
That's a lot. You know, for someone at this level of work output, some anxiety about like maybe eating yams and sweet potatoes at every meal, I think that's well founded just on a boredom kind of scene. Somebody putting work output at this level, maybe a day of yam and sweet potato, a day of bananas, a day of watermelon. I mean, you could definitely mix this stuff up. Somebody in this kind of camp, this reminds me of Glenn when Glenn's in fight prep, where he's doing 3 sessions a day, grappling, kickboxing, an S&C deal. You just need to eat. I definitely would recommend a focus on like coconut milk and coconut oil. You can, depending on where you live, you should be able to get like the big gallon tubs of Tropical Traditions coconut oil, which is a really cost-effective way to get a lot of kind of coconut calories all in one spot. And then get it whatever, you know, greenery you can get in, multi-vegetables and all that for just nutrient quality. But you really need to focus on hunks of protein, lots of fat, post-workout carbs, maybe even for you, depending on the volume of work you're doing, some significant pre-workout carbs too. So, I mean, it just boils down to eat more. Don't be afraid of fruit. Don't be afraid. You know, I would stick more with the high glycemic index fruit, because that's going to minimize the fructose intake you're putting in. But just mix that stuff up between yams, sweet potatoes, bananas, plantains, melons, berries. I mean, I could sit down and eat like an ungodly amount of watermelon. So I know I can absolutely destroy that stuff. And even though it's not very calorically dense, I can get some calories down. So mix that stuff up as much as you can from a nutrient standpoint. It'll keep your palate kind of going because you've got something new in there. Maybe one day a week, kick your heels up and have some non-gluten containing, you know, like Mexican food or Thai food or something, and go for like some rice or something like that, just for a little bit of variety and to really top off the glycogen stores. And otherwise, I think you're doing great. It sounds good. Just sounds like you're under eating and possibly overthinking this. Like somebody at your work output could stand to eat more fruit. Don't need to worry so much about the fructose and all that sort of jive. And unless you start seeing body fat gain, or if you were to look at some blood work and we see some like triglycerides kind of go in the wrong direction, then we could maybe reel stuff back in. But other than that, you should be good to go.
And I thought the comment that he made was pretty interesting. Like, I feel like the answer is that he must absolutely start chugging coconut milk or doing shots of olive oil, but I'm not a big fan of just consuming calories to get calories. But I feel like at his level of work output, he needs to consume calories just to fuel how much work he's doing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you pointed that out. That actually was kind of a dichotomous thing. It was like, on the one hand, I can't eat enough, but yet I don't feel like I want to eat just for eating's sake. And it's like, no, that's exactly what you need to do. You're an engine, and you need to fuel, or you'll see suboptimum performance. I mean, There's just absolutely no doubt about that. Some of the old Perillo bodybuilding stuff of, you know, there's no overtraining, there's just undereating, which I think is kind of far-fetched. You know, if you take enough drugs, and that's maybe true, but in general, there's no doubt that if you fuel your body much better, you're going to recover much better. I mean, people doing starting strength, linear progression type stuff, I mean, you can just almost eat your way out of, into a forever linear progression with strength. And to some degree, I think that's what you got to do when you're a high-level athlete like this. Like, you really need to fuel adequately.
Yep. All right, good. Good question. Next, we got a question for Robert. Rob, in the podcast, you talked about how defining your goals should dictate how you approach and design your workouts, i.e. max performance versus health and longevity. I'm curious as to what your workouts look like. What do you do in the gym? Do you follow a template in the fashion of something like Max Effort Black Box? This is perfect, Rob. I just saw you almost die in the gym like an hour ago. So.
Oh, man, I'm a horrible person on this stuff because I have the tendency of bouncing around. But, you know, I've had a problem for a long time in that I started doing kind of CrossFit type stuff in 2002 and dug it for a long time. And then at a certain point was kind of over it. You know, I still see so much efficacy out of this circuit type training and the intensity and all that. But then from just kind of like a feeding my soul and kind of an interest kind of gig, it was like, I just don't know how many more like 400 meter runs plus kettlebell swing plus pull-ups I've got in me that, you know, is really all that interesting. And Chico was kind of tough because there wasn't a good Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu class that was going on that fit with my schedule. And then recently we got Bruno Lima at Standalone Martial Arts, and so we started doing some Jiu-Jitsu. And when I finally had a sport that I was actually focusing my efforts on, it made everything so much easier because I largely got the conditioning that I needed from doing my sport. And then outside of that, I did a little bit of conditioning, but really I didn't have a whole lot left in the tank. I did strength and power development work, mobility work, and some kind of sport, you know, general preparation, but also some specific preparation. And I was super happy with that. And so when my stuff got better, or when it's been better, like when I was playing capoeira, I oriented my strength and conditioning to support the capoeira, and then I really enjoyed playing capoeira. And when I did Thai boxing, kind of the same thing. And then when I've had periods of time where I just didn't have anything to focus on, then it made it really hard to get in the gym. And I think I ended up bouncing around all the time because I just didn't have anything to focus my goals. So now that I'm getting in and kind of doing these old dude grappling tournaments and stuff like that, like I've got much more focus with all of this. And I think something like a max effort black box or a Wendler 5-3-1, where you're really, for me, because I'm kind of focusing on grappling, I might consider some MMA stuff at some point, but probably just doing grappling for right now, because I think getting hit in the head at this point is probably not in my best interest, but it's always a possibility out there. But, you know, I've got this thing that focuses my efforts, and so then I can look at what my game is, and then I can kind of steer the boat in a supportive direction, and I have a pretty good focus on kind of a health and longevity bias. So, like, I'm really emphasizing mobility. I love doing a lot of gymnastics rings work and stuff like that for my upper body. So, like today, I did a max effort, like a 3x5, and then three sets of three. Finding a max five, and then a max triple on the parallel bar dip, and I ended up working up to 81. Body weight plus 81 kilos for a triple in the parallel bar dip. And then I did a couple of a rope climb ascents, just basically two ascents at a shot. And our rope's about 12 feet high, 14 feet high. So I was able to stay on the rope, climb all the way up, go all the way back down, and then go back up again without coming off the rope. And then I hooked up this horrible workout outside in which I had a 15-foot length of an inch and a half diameter rope, what we would normally use for like rope climbs. I hooked that up to the prowler, and I had 90 pounds of Olympic plates on the prowler and two 45-pound dumbbells. And so I would pull the prowler with that weight 15 feet, run around to the backside of the prowler, do five push press with the 45-pound dumbbells, and then sprint the distance that I had just pulled the prowler to this starting point. And so I started on this course that we usually call our 100-meter sprint course. And each time I pulled the prowler, my sprint distance got longer and longer. And I basically did like 16 lengths of that out in the sun, and it was like 98 degrees, and I wanted to die. Like, it was horrible, but it was very punctuated, and it really kind of interesting, because each time I did my sprint, my rest from the rope pulls and the push presses got longer and longer, but then the run got longer and longer. So instead of it just being like a set course, you know, like 400 meter run, 12 kettlebell swings, 21 pull-ups, and it's the same thing each time, I really try to look at some workouts, if I'm doing circuit type stuff, where there's some different variation within the workout. And a way that I almost tweaked this workout was going slightly lighter on the push press, and then alternating the first round of push press would have been 5 reps, second round of push press would have been 10, third round of 15, and then restarting with that. So basically doing a mini ladder within the push press round. But that's real typical of what I'm doing right now. Usually some sort of a max effort gig, either a press or a pull, some sort of lower body movement, usually an Olympic movement. Josh Hankin hooked us up with some really phenomenal sandbags, and so I've been using those a bunch in my conditioning circuits, because the movement pattern is different enough from my Olympic lifts that it doesn't goof anything up. It has this really nasty flap that you can hang onto the sandbag, and it's exactly like grabbing the collar or the sleeve in a judo or jiu-jitsu, so it's really been helping with my grip. And so I've been doing a lot of sandbag work, like get-ups, clean snatches, all kinds of goofy stuff with that. But that's kind of a typical day for me.
Nice. All right. Rob Wolf on his training.
And it definitely, like, it's so much more enjoyable. Like, Bruno is gone for a month back to Brazil, and I'm spinning out because I don't have that focus of a sport that I really want to do. And so it's way more difficult to stay focused when I don't have that sport that I'm hitting 3-4 times a week. So I you know, if your gig is like the sport of fitness, then God love you, like focus on it and really, really tackle it. in a smart, concerted effort. But if you're kind of lackadaisical about your training, I would find something that you're kind of interested in, whether it's rock climbing or swimming, God forbid, even like sprint triathlon, like whatever you want to do. But find something that gives your training some meaning. And frequently it means doing something out of the gym, unless you're doing like Olympic lifting or strongman or powerlifting or something like that. And then, you know, your sport kind of is your training then.
Yep. All right, good. Next, we got a question from Tony. Rob, you always contrast elite fitness versus longevity, health, and diets. Most questions focus on the latter. What is the macro and post-workout diet suggestions for elites? Thanks.
You know, how do I want to tackle it? Typically, elite just means more. I mean, whether we're talking Olympic weightlifting or whether we're talking like Greco-Roman wrestling, like people are doing a lot more work and at a much higher work output than the average person. And so like we've been working with some Olympic lifters at the Olympic Training Center, and their food looks completely different than say like somebody who's training for Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or kickboxing. It's still paleo, but the macros end up breaking down much, much differently. But both groups of athletes, or whether we're talking a strength athlete, like a 105 kilo Olympic lifter, or whether we're talking like a 75 kilo grappler, their specific macros end up breaking down quite differently. A strength endurance athlete, like a grappler or a kickboxer, they're going to have adequate protein, you know, probably about a gram of protein per pound of body weight. Quite a bit of carbohydrate, typically focused on the post-workout period, but potentially elsewhere based on training volume and recovery and just how that person runs, and then making up the balance of the calories from good fats to help control insulin levels, to keep the person in a little bit more of an anabolic state and stuff like that. Whereas like the Olympic lifter, really we're placing a premium on muscle mass at a given body weight, and usually a lot of these guys, it's relatively hard to get them big and maintain good body composition. So for these folks, we typically do a cyclic low carb, possibly some post-workout dairy if we're really challenged with putting some weight on the individual, and focusing on grass-fed dairy at just about all costs. And this works really, really well. Like we're able to get big dudes leaner, and then the United States is just really tight. At least USA Weightlifting, they are so tight on the drug testing. It's really remarkable. Like I've been rather flip in the past about all Olympians are on drugs of one type or another, but I would go out on a limb and say that the 90% of our Olympic weightlifting team is clean, because like an IOC judge practically lives in their like urethra or something. It's like they get tested all the time. So they have to really, I think, relative to the rest of the international field, they have to really focus on their food. And it's hilarious what they tried to feed them out of the Olympic Training Center. So the macro is just going to, for elite athletes, it's just going to play out again based on what their body composition needs are, what their work output is. Typically, more metabolic work is going to require more carbohydrate. If we're placing a premium on size and muscle mass, then we're probably going to go higher protein, higher fat, and control insulin and try to create as anabolic an environment as we can. Maybe a little bit of post-workout carbs or post-workout dairy based on what the needs are, but much more of a premium on protein and fat than we would see with other more endurance athletes, I guess.
Yep. Good. Rob Wolf, we're making progress today, buddy. We got
we're carving through it.
Slow but steady, kind of like my training. I'm going to butcher this name. So next question is from Rahif. That's the best I got.
Yeah.
I have an unusual question concerning fasting from the hours of sun up to sunset for a period of 30 days. For religious reasons, I have to take a complete fast, no food or drink of any kind from sunrise until sunset. I'm an avid CrossFitter and currently working on increasing my CrossFit total and my Olympic total. A little background is I am a male, 28 years old, 6'4", 205, and I CrossFit no less than six times a week and work on strength three times a week. Also, I eat mostly paleo aside from very little dairy and some black beans to get in some carbs. I get extremely dizzy if I only get carbs from veggies. I try to eat at least 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, mostly from meat sources and salmon. My questions are basically, how, what should I eat, considering that I can only eat and drink at night? What kind of training volume would you recommend? And do you think I should focus primarily on strength workouts of short but heavy sets? And if so, add a Metcon after or just Metcon on different days? This is a question I've had for years, and now that I've found your blog and podcast, I'm sure I'll get some light shed on the subject. Thanks again for sharing your wealth of knowledge with us. Can't wait for the book to come out. Keep up the great work.
You know, I've had a number of questions like this, and so I think we're kind of coming up on Ramadan, and a lot of people are kind of faced with this thing of, like, how do I keep my training solid while adhering to this fasting that I need to do? And I think, you know, a lot of the recommendations that we see out of the intermittent fasting stuff that I've written about, that we see from, like, Martin, I think is perfect for this scenario. If you are generally recovering from your workouts, then, you know, kind of a preponderance of protein and fat, so that we're really reversing any type of catabolism that's going on, any type of muscle breakdown, and also just getting in as many calories as we possibly can. I would probably shift things a little bit more on the strength bias for a month. And I would keep maybe 2 days a week of doing some shorter Metcons, maybe 3 days a week of some shorter Metcons, but then really focusing on kind of a strength bias during this period. I think that would be less stressful. It would be less challenging to recover from that activity, because I'm assuming that you're going to have to work out and then fast after the workout. And so I would be reticent to send too much of, like, a really difficult to recover from signal into your body, which would be like a big metabolic conditioning deal, or like a big bodybuilding type deal or something like that. I would focus more often on doing strength work. And then if you could time it, if you're going to do metabolic conditioning type stuff, I would try to do that right before then sundown occurs, when you're going to be able to eat. And then I would do that metabolic conditioning, then eat a protein carbohydrate meal immediately, possibly even like a shake or something like that. Like, you just have to play with how you're going with that. Do a protein carbohydrate meal immediately, then maybe 35, 45 minutes later, really lay into a protein fat meal. But I would, that's the way I would tackle this. I've recommended this to maybe 4 or 5 people now that I've received kind of private emails or like Facebook messages and stuff like that. And folks have been tinkering with this and getting some pretty good results. So I think it's a perfect opportunity to do a little bit of a forced or planned periodization in your programming. And then when you're able to go back to normal eating, then you can switch things up.
Yep. Rob, we're going to skip the next question for now. We'll come back to that next week.
Okay.
So we're going to do a follow-up from Kevin. He says, quick follow-up question on the gluten avoidance issue. What is your take on the differences between the, please pronounce that for me, Rob.
Gliadins,
thank you. Founded wheat and those found in other grains such as barley. By the way, did you see someone send an email making fun of my lack of pronunciation skills?
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah. I think it'll be a next week's show. It's pretty funny.
Nice.
Basically, and I can't remember what the term was, but it was a pretty lengthy medical diagnosis. And then in parentheses, he was like, good luck with Andy pronouncing this.
Nice.
I'm like, dang it. Do you believe people who have issues with gluten should be equally strict on both of them? I ask because although I would know all about it if I had some bread, I've had little problems on the likes of Guinness. However, I've recently been mulling over cutting out a monthly Guinness binge after listening to the interview on Underground Wellness with Dr. Tom O'Brien, which scared the crap out of me. So my question really is, what do you think your see how you feel look perform is still up to the task of guiding optimum food choices when given the damage gliadin-containing foodstuffs could be causing under the surface without notable physical effects? Really what I'm hoping you might tell me is that I can keep getting trolleyed on Guinness every once in a while, but my gut feeling tells me otherwise. Thanks for all your hard work. I've got the book on advance order.
This is a good one.
Why are all... Once again, it's back to this. All these like life or death questions are always about alcohol.
About booze, yeah. Probably because the booze plays into your social and sex life so much. So there's some critical stuff going on with this. I was talking to Scotty Hagness about some of this stuff, and like, he did a bunch of like kind of gut health stuff. He did a heavy metal cleanse. He did a really aggressive probiotic round. And then after that, he was actually able to drink some things like Guinness, and it didn't seem to bother him all that much. Bothered him a little bit, but before that, he was about as sensitive to this stuff as I was. I've been wanting to tinker with this, and I would probably not drink the Guinness just because I would just want to not be destroyed when I get cross-contamination while I'm traveling. Like, I would be happy with that. Like, I'm cool drinking NorCal margaritas and just kind of running scared from the rest of this stuff. But the reality is we don't really know exactly how much damage any of this stuff is causing. Some people are super, super sensitive to the proline-rich protein, which that's what we're talking about with regards to these things, like the gluten and the gliadin and all that stuff. Like Zein, which is the protein-rich protein or a proline-rich protein found in corn, some people react to Zein just as badly as they do gluten, or like other people do gluten. There are autoimmune diseases kind of related to that, and Zein intolerance and all that sort of jive. It's not as common, but it's there. And then like Dutch Lowy, he can handle a little bit of gluten. Like he'll have a little, you know, have a little bread. He'll have a little standard beer. He'll notice it a little bit of gut wonkiness and stuff like that. And he doesn't feel super good the next day, but it's not that big of a deal. But then when he tried having some Red Bridge, which is sorghum, it destroyed him. I mean, just like laid him up. And he felt the way that I usually feel if I get a standard gluten dose. So it's quite variable. What we know for a fact is that these proline-rich proteins, which are in all grains, have some degree of potential problem with regards to damaging the gut and causing subsequent issues. And I'm still wanting to read the Primal Body, Primal Mind and kind of see what her perspective is on this. And Andy, I think you let the trainers at NorCal know that all of her show notes or podcasts are available now. So there might be some information hidden in some of those. But I mean, this is just to some degree a crapshoot. And in general, I kind of err on the side of like clear booze and lime juice and soda water and call it good. I do hit a little bit of a gluten-free beer here and there, but I don't know. I mean, I miss my Guinness. I loved that stuff, but I know for a fact it does not work well with me, and that this is just one of those cost-benefit things you got to figure out. I don't have an exact number on this stuff.
Yeah, and to follow up on the Primal Body, Primal Mind, she had a radio show, and she just started putting them all on iTunes. So if you Google Primal Body, Primal Mind, you can listen to all the episodes, which are amazing and very interesting. So well worth the download to listen to when you're riding on the train, walking in the park, whatever people do. Maybe people listen to it while they eat dinner, like some people listen to our podcast, which just scares the bejesus out of me.
That is horrifying, yes.
Anyway, all right, good question. Moving on, we're making progress. We're only at 48 minutes, Rob.
Sweet.
Question from David. I have recently been getting into mountaineering, which is pretty awesome, but seems to be a sport that is difficult to do while being completely paleo. I climbed Cotopaxi, a 19,000-foot volcano in Ecuador last winter, and I tried to stay away from most of the candy bars and straight pasta meals that the rest of my group was eating, but it was difficult. I'm going on a 6-day mountaineering course in the Cascades in August, and I have to pack my own food. The school recommends large amounts of complex carbs as they provide extra calories and are easily digested. Fats and proteins, they say, are not as easily digested and not as good to bring on the trip. Do you have any suggestions? What subs for breakfast when everyone is eating oatmeal? I'm worried about what I can carry in terms of keeping things fresh, as well as how it will affect me and how heavy it all is. Any thoughts are appreciated.
You know, the elevation issue is a real factor, because as you go up in elevation, our metabolism shifts to more and more carbohydrate preferential metabolism. So fat metabolism at elevation gets a little bit more difficult. It's more oxygen demanding. So you have some cost benefit stuff. You need to play around with that. You know, really, so when they're talking about ease of digestion, that's what these folks are talking about. But the reality is that if we are talking about just pure, you know, calories per gram of load, there's no doubt that carrying a minimum amount of protein, minimum amount of carb, and maximum fat is the way that you would go. And it would almost be something like a pemmican type deal, where it's mainly fat, you know, like coconut oil or something, with enough nuts, seeds, and dried fruit, and maybe a little bit of jerky mixed in there. The dried fruit would be really handy because you would want enough sweet so that you could really put stuff down. And I think that is like an amazing optimized solution. I used to make this stuff. I would get the either Tropical Traditions or Barleen's has a really non-reactive, high-impact plastic container that they put the coconut oil in when you get like about 16 ounces of it. I would get a couple of those, and I would empty one of them. You basically have to kind of melt it, put it in some warm water, melt it, pour that into like a glass jar or something. But then you can take like a trail mix kind of concoction that is heavy in dried fruit, and then basically pour some melted coconut oil back into that container, close it, and there you go. When it solidifies, then you can just spoon the stuff out, and it should be pretty homogeneous. Like there should be a consistency throughout the whole thing that should work for you, and you just spoon the thing out. It's massively calorically dense. It's light. You might get sick of that stuff at some point, and so, you know, for like a breakfast, like a nutty hot cereal like ground almonds or something like that with some dried fruit in it again would be really, really good. Very, very calorically dense. And if you need more carbs, then do more dried fruit. I think that's like calorie per gram of load as good as you're going to get out of all this stuff. Whether or not that's going to be optimum fueling given the altitude that you're at, I don't know. Like, you might benefit more from more carbs given the altitude that you're running at. You could try mainly getting that from dried fruit. If you have to start getting into like some power bars or different things like that, or like the Laura bars, then obviously that's some place that you could go. But I think you can kind of concoct things that are very, very similar to that on your own and kind of optimize your own fueling.
Yep. Good. All right. Next, we got a comment from a question from Connor. Hey, Rob, I was wondering what your take is on tyrosine supplementation for optimizing mental alertness and offsetting fatigue, and what dosage will be necessary to get benefits. I'm sneaking in a supplementation question, Rob. Ha!
Bastard. So tyrosine is a precursor on some adrenal hormones. It's also a precursor for dopamine. So it can be helpful to some degree in some recovery protocols from heavy training. Can also be helpful pre-workout for a very neuro-based training. So like you're a power lifter or an O-lifter and you're going to go do a big kind of max effort, you know, 90% type gig. Some tyrosine 45 minutes before a workout, 3 to 5 grams. Take that with a little DMAE, dimethyl amino ethanol bitartrate, and you'll be cooking. You need to moderate those doses, though. Like, it can overdo you. And you can get a little overstimulated, especially if you do some caffeine along with that. But otherwise, it's a good supplement. Very specific, so I usually don't get in and talk a lot about that stuff. But it definitely can be helpful.
Yep. All right. Next, we got a question from Lauren. Hey, Rob, thanks to you, I feel like I really get metabolism and it applies to macronutrients and systemic health. What I'm dying to know more about is specifically how to approach training for optimal health and longevity. 27, I've been doing CrossFit for 1.5 years, paleo for 9 months. I've experienced the initial massive improvements starting as a CrossFit beginner and have also experienced overtraining and likely adrenal fatigue several times. At this point, I'm interested in continued strength gain without complete loss of Metcon abilities, and I don't want to keep beating myself up into the ground. Several times you have mentioned linear strength progression and periodization, but I don't know how to implement it. Do you have to commit to one program, such as 5-3-1, Black Box, or Starting Strength, and later add in more Metcon? Are these programs meant to be short-term, or can you continue them long-term? After gaining all my strength goals, is CrossFit alone sustainable long-term? What if you hit every watt at 80%, not 100%? I feel like I'm wandering around in the dark with this because I don't know where I'm going with all of this. What does a year or two down the road look like for health and longevity? Thanks for sharing your brain with all of us. We appreciate it more than you could know. She also goes on to say, I guess I should add, I don't have any health problems, no autoimmune disease or metabolic derangement issues. I'm at an acceptable weight and fitness level at present. I also sleep great. I basically want to reach at or near my potential while maintaining health and longevity.
Wow, this is kind of a big one. I think that this is another one that I almost feel like a a sportive focus would be helpful. I think to some degree, like that, you know, when you say health and longevity bias, and like I'm as bad a person talking about that as anybody, but it is kind of nebulous. It's like, well, what are you doing and what are you doing it for? I think the question is, do you have to commit to one program? No, you definitely don't. I think playing with different things you can get benefit from them. Starting strength will peter out at some point, and you'll have to shift gears from that. That one is legitimately and admittedly by Ripito, it's a beginner's program, and you're going to run out of that. 531 or Max Effort Black Box, I think you could run with variants on those themes pretty much your whole life, and you'd be good to go with that. Hit every watt at 80% instead of 100%. Yeah, probably. That's probably a good go around on that. I think that there's a lot of different ways that you could tackle this. We talked earlier in the podcast about some people like Clarence Bass and Dave Draper, you know, who've tackled all this stuff from a bodybuilding perspective and I think done really well with it. Jack LaLanne had more of a bodybuilding and a calisthenics orientation and obviously has done really well with this stuff, but usually had some kind of performance goals that he was doing because he was doing all these wacky events like, 1,000 pull-ups, 1,000 push-ups in an hour or something like that, or dragging 70 people in boats while he was shackled, you know, hand and foot while swimming in the English Channel and wacky stuff like that. But he had some interesting points of focus with what he was doing with his training. And the longer I go along with this stuff, I really think that that's important. Like when I see some people like Danjon, who has competed at a high level, but, you know, he's stuck in this, like, lifting, throwing, Highland gaming. And he does it in a yearly fashion such that he has events that he looks forward to. Like, it's not just the training, but it's also, like, the socializing and the fun element of it. And he doesn't beat himself to death doing it. And he just keeps chugging along and doing it at a really high level. Like, it's a really, really cool. And I think a lot to be learned from that. So I think in some ways, kind of doing this for a reason more than simply health and longevity, because then you have some sort of a focused goal that you're doing. And whether it's mountaineering or ballroom dancing or, you know, whatever it is that you're doing, if you have some sort of a specific focus, then the health and longevity thing almost feels a little bit like admonishing people to lose weight or something like that. Like, it's not that fun. It's just, oh, I'm going to live a long time and I'll look pretty good. And that's kind of motivating, but it's not that motivating. And again, like, I'm as bad as anybody about giving lip service to this health and longevity bias. But the more I think about that, I think that that's a really good perspective to have. But I think it needs to be backseat to some sort of a focus with your training. Like, why are you training? What is it that you want to do? If you're just kind of generally... You still enjoy working out and you're not real specific about what you're doing, I think something that looks like a Max Effort Black Box with some sprinting, some macro climbing type stuff like backer ladders and ropes and, you know, a lot of the cool stuff out of Move Nat, I think would be really, really fun. And it keeps you mobile, it keeps you strong, keeps a base level of conditioning that's really good. I think that's good to go. I've been revisiting, at least in my head, some of the old Art Devaney stuff, like his first essay when he was talking about like hierarchical sets of back squats and deadlifts, and then alactic sets of squats and deadlifts, and occasional sprint days and some backpack days and everything. And when I rattle that stuff around in my head, like when I was doing that, I really, really enjoyed myself. It was super time efficient, and I got really good results. And I wasn't super neurotic about what I was doing. And I was hitting enough bodybuilder type stuff where I maintained a little bit of muscle mass. Not that I've ever really gotten all that big, but, you know, it was good for me. And then maintained a good level of strength without all that much effort. And it was really kind of a minimum investment, maximum return on it. And I know he's kind of tinkered his stuff to make it a little more accessible using some machines and whatnot, but I think that early work that he had was really, really good. And at some point I'd kind of like to revisit that and make like an evolutionary fitness template and ship it to him and see if he doesn't doesn't like it or wants to kill me for doing it or whatever. But I really, really like some of that old stuff that he generated, which is very minimalistic. I think that there's kind of two interesting camps in this regard. And Michael Rutherford, if folks ever get a chance to see his Max Effort Black Box talk, it's one, it's outstanding. And then two, he makes a point when you're thinking about your own training, are you a recovery midget or a recovery giant? You know, do you have big recovery capacity or small recovery capacity? And so I think people like Rutt and then people like Art Devaney, Clarence Bass, they've kind of adopted the approach of what's the minimum investment, what's the minimum signal I can send into my body to get the maximum return, which I think in a lot of ways is really smart. And then on this other side is this kind of CrossFit-esque approach, which is how much work can I put into my body before it breaks? And we're not always real clear about that. And I think that there was a time when CrossFit was far more oriented on the, let's be kind of cocksure about how little work we did, but how good we look and how much cool stuff we can do despite how little investment that we did. And it was short couplets and triplets that had some moderate motor skill demands going into more greater motor skill demands and stuff like that. Fran, Diane, Helen, things like that, that were really powerful and really, really good, but I think also left a lot of recovery capacity in people instead of tapping out the recovery capacity. And so, you know, we've obviously had several health and longevity oriented questions here, but there's some really interesting stuff to think about in that regard. Like, we want to build capacity. We'd like to be active and do a lot of different stuff, but I'd like to see a lot of that stuff happen outside of the gym. Like to see you playing frisbee or doing stand-up paddleboarding or rock climbing or hiking or, you know, like almost anything besides simply being in the gym. Do the gym so that you can do the rest of your life more effectively would be like my ideal thing, because people stick with that stuff for life.
Yeah, and I think what's nice about some of the stuff you mentioned, the rock climbing, paddleboard, stand-up paddleboard, there's a lot of proprioceptive stuff as well, where you're actually having to figure out how your body moves and, you know, a lot of balance and coordination stuff that you don't always get when you're chasing the clock and or doing some of the traditional exercises in the gym.
Yeah, and it doesn't, you know, redline your heart rate, but it's really tough. And if you don't practice it, you don't get better at it. And I think to some degree it's that learning new things that really keeps you interested throughout life. You know, yep. It's good stuff.
I'll talk about that on time. Two quick questions I just wanted to focus on for Lauren here. So one, when and if she achieves her strength goals, is CrossFit alone sustainable long term? 20-second answer, Rob. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's sustainable long-term, but you need to play with it and do a lot of variety, and I would still encourage people to look at the outer edges of the technique margins, stuff like MoveNat, stuff like gymnastics. Like, you need to broaden out your scope besides simply squat, push-up, pull-up, thruster. Like, you need to do new shit. You learn some kickboxing, do some jiu-jitsu, take a ballroom dance class and stuff like that. Like, the skill set needs to grow.
And all that stuff you can develop, I think, a fair amount of work capacity and have fun without beating the crap out of yourself every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
And then the other thing I thought was interesting just to touch on is she was saying, you know, do I need to commit to one program such as 5-3-1 Black Box with starting strength and only add in more Metcon? Or can she add in more Metcon now? Kind of what's your thoughts about that?
Well, it depends on, you know, like starting strength has no Metcon.
Right.
So Max Effort Black Box, if you're following Rutt's site, has some programmed in Metcon, which I would love to see people do that. You know, follow Rutt's site, follow the Max Effort template, follow the metabolic conditioning stuff that he has there. And then on the off days, he has 3 days a week of programming, 3 other days a week. I'd like to see you doing something active, playing frisbee, going swimming, riding the bike. I mean, like doing anything that's just out and about and active. And maybe you get a little spunky about one of those things and you find some performance parameter you want to chase. You want to be part-time on an ultimate frisbee team or something like that. You know, whatever it is, you have something that you're doing with a little bit of focus so that you go back to your in-the-gym stuff and you're like, oh man, if I really work my Olympic lifts a little bit, then I notice that my sprint and takeoff when I'm playing Ultimate or I'm playing soccer is better, you know, or I need to work a little bit more on my intervals, my running intervals, so that I've got a little bit more recovery between rounds playing basketball or something like that. So it gives you a little bit of focus in that regard. But there's just so much dynamicism and so much more interesting stuff that happens in sports versus in the gym. You know, it's just that trying to get people out and do new things is just so valuable, whether it's a dance class or a martial arts class, getting a private lesson in tennis or basketball or anything. Like, there's so much more cognitive difficulty doing a sport versus lifting weights and working out that it benefits people so much and on so many different levels.
Yeah, and I feel like, Rob and I have been talking offline. I'm working on a blog post about things I don't like about CrossFit. But one of the interesting things that I always struggle with at CrossFit, and when you look at like some of like Ito's work, which you know you see in spades in his, is everything in CrossFit is so freaking linear. You know, we're always doing bilateral movements, which makes sense when you're trying to do max loading and stuff. But every sprint is linear, and that's just such a small component of what's possible as far as total physical movement. And we're doing nothing laterally. We're doing nothing rotationally. And some of my thoughts are like, spend some time outside of the gym doing stuff in those other dimensions rather than spending all your time doing everything kind of in one plane of motion, which is just so limited compared to what's possible.
Oh yeah, I mean the Move Nat deal was such a great eye opener for that. Like, you're running through the woods barefoot, and like we would do these drills where like a person would throw an object at you and you would have to catch it, and it would usually be a heavy object like a rock. And we went through drills starting from a very stable, safe beginning, and then made it very dynamic and very open-ended, and like climbing over objects, climbing on top of objects, throwing objects over, and having somebody on the other side have to catch it, and different things. Like you're talking about, even some of the really basic sprint drills using cones and whatnot are really, really demanding on a neurological basis, connective tissue and all that sort of stuff. And I think there's just huge developmental potential, and they're a lot of fun. But it takes you away from the 3-2-1 go stopwatch kind of stuff, because technique degrades, form degrades really quickly. These things will not tolerate a 20% slop, and really there's no point to making it that specifically a competitive element. It's something to be tinkered with in like an artistic endeavor to make it perfect and make it fun, and make it kind of an outward expression of who you are and what you're doing and what type of stuff you're trying to do with your life, more than simply a beatdown.
Yeah, and I think Starrett and I had this conversation a couple weeks ago into CM, was that, in some of the fitness communities, I'll use kettlebells as an example, like you'll see people talk about the concept of owning movements and kind of exploring slight changes in their swings over 5 to 10 years and kind of, searching for optimal kind of performance as well as kind of optimal, aesthetics. And you don't see that oftentimes in, the strength community by itself or CrossFit, because we're so focused on just the total amount of weight or, how fast we can get something done. And I feel like there's a lot of cool stuff that goes on when you look at some of these movements, even like the squat differently. Starrett's always talking about you should have 20 different squatting patterns. And obviously you're not going to load them all the same, but you know how to use your hips in 20 different ways. And I feel like there's a lot of benefit for folks to start thinking about some of that rather than, sure, if you're a power lifter, we're talking about a different story. But if you're just a generalist out there trying to be healthy and fit, I think there's a lot of kind of dimensions that you can explore that will benefit you much more long term, rather than just the total amount of weight or just how fast I can get this given amount of work done.
Yeah, and especially when we start seeing form degradation and or overtraining.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. Any topic about something like this spins us off for like 20 minutes.
Well, it's interesting stuff, and I mean, it, a lot of people are talking about these things. Like, there's a lot of fun and some strong impact with this type of training, but also we're seeing now people who've been doing it for anywhere from like 1 year to 6 or 7 years, and the cumulative micro trauma, the kind of psychological elements of continuing training like this is a really important thing to kind of keep in mind.
Sure. And final question from
Big Daddy. Woohoo!
Rob just finished reading Lights Out and was wondering about the idea of eating plenty of carbs via fruits and veggies in the summer and greatly reducing or limiting carbs in the winter. If I read correctly, Wiley said we should put on weight during summer months when fruits and veggies are plentiful and cut back when the season is cold and less carbs are available naturally. I'm 97.64% paleo, with cheats being 90% dark chocolate bar once a week and heavy cream in my decaf. Charleston, South Carolina, male. 6'5", 230, 35-year-old CrossFit 3 to 4 times a week, but increase RX weight and work at 60 to 70% max effort. 5,000 milligrams of vitamin D, tons of fish oil and magnesium, not concerned with body comp, but rather focused on great health, energy levels, and disease-free life.
I think this is a great formula to follow, and it just psychologically, I think it's good because in the spring, summer, fall, we see a huge profusion of fruits and veggies that are more carbohydrate dense for the most part, and I think it just kind of, it's a nice spot to kind of loosen things up and have more of that stuff. If you've got some metabolic problems, then you maybe don't have as much latitude with it, but I think for most folks, they get a lot more latitude with it. And then on the back side of that, I think being ketogenic, quasi-ketogenic for a chunk of the year, three to six months of the year, is a really smart thing to do from a health standpoint. And if you modify your training to kind of match that, you know, during that ketogenic period, you're probably doing much more strength work, much shorter metcons. It's a great opportunity to kind of periodize your training. So I dig it. I like it. Like I usually, I think it's like 5 years straight now, you know, I do like the yearly call to remind people about Lights Out, just an outstanding book. Usually people either love it or hate it, but the fundamental message of like sleep and sleeping in the dark, controlling cortisol, controlling insulin, is an amazingly prescient book. Very, very good.
Yep. And with that, Rob, that is the end of episode 42, or the answer to everything.
Holy cats, we've answered it all with this episode, so we're done. It's all over.
All right, Rob, an hour and 11 minutes, so okay. I will talk to you next week.
We beefed that one up. Cool, Andy. Thanks a lot.
All right, see you, Rob.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.